Hello and welcome to the Respiratory Exchange podcast. I'm Rai Dwake, chairman of the Respiratory Institute at Cleveland Clinic. This podcast series of short, digestible episodes is intended for healthcare providers and covers topics related to respiratory health and disease. My colleagues and I will be interviewing experts about timely and timeless topics in the areas of pulmonary, critical care, sleep, infectious disease, and related disciplines. We will share information that will help you take better care of your patients today, as well as the patients of tomorrow. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
I just want to say I'm very excited about this podcast that we're doing. My name is Steve Gordon. I'm chairman of the Department of Infectious Disease and Infectious Disease Clinician. And we have really two young rising talent guests here, Dr. Hannah Wang and Dr. Chris Attaway. And they are representing a key component, at least as an ID specialist, our kind of three-legged stool here, and that's the microbiology lab. And I think the goals of this podcast are, we'll focus on the micro lab, in particular in terms of respiratory viruses and RSV testing, but also the importance of what behind that black box is, and as I like to frame it, in a solutions business for clinicians to help us get a rapid diagnosis in certain things and initiate treatment when needed. But before we get into, I think, the nitty-gritty, I first want to direct my first question to Dr. Hannah Wang. And Hannah, welcome. And can you just tell us a little bit about your journey and how you got here to the Cleveland Clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So my name is Hannah Wang. My journey at Cleveland started in medical school here. I came to Cleveland Clinic for medical school in 2012. And it was here in the micro lab here that I developed a love for pathology, lab medicine, and diagnostic testing. And I went out to Stanford to do my pathology residency and microbiology fellowship. And now, as of August 2022, I started here as the medical director of molecular microbiology and virology. And I oversee a lot of the respiratory virus testing that's done for this hospital and for Northeast Ohio.
Well, thank you, Hannah. And we'll get back to, you know, your return was actually very prescient because you came in the medias race of the COVID epidemic in terms of this. Chris, I wonder if you could tell us your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thank you for having us. I'm Dr. Gordon. So I always like to tell people I am just a humble boy from rural South Carolina. But I went to undergrad there. And then from there, actually, I worked in an intimidated histolytical lab. So I got my first exposure to infectious disease back then, even. And from there, I was contacted with somebody at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I did a degree, my master's degree there in medical parasitology. So then I was even more interested, imagine. And then from there, I went to medical school at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And from there, I made my way to every other microbiologist, did my anatomic and clinical pathology residencies at the University of Pennsylvania. And from there, had some people told me that there's this really great place in Northeast Ohio that I should really continue my training at. And I applied, and they were really outstanding. So I'm really proud to join the group, and I'm happy to learn from our amazing medical directors and infectious disease colleagues.
Well, thank you, Chris. And as you know, it's been a great two-way street in terms of the micro lab so embedded in our practice. But Anna, if I can direct you, so I think many people probably pre-pandemic weren't really maybe had a good, awareness of respiratory viral testing. And now we've evolved to probably one of the more successful platforms, I think, from the pandemic, and that was the availability of home testing point of care. But I wonder if you can give us just an overview as you look at respiratory virus testing in general, kind of the ABCs for our home audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to be honest, these days our home audience doesn't need the ABCs anymore, right? We went from like a situation where really nobody really understood what lab testing was or how it was accomplished, maybe even what the most common respiratory viruses were. And with COVID, sort of, we started with really not having access to testing, right? Very few tests being developed. And now this sort of explosion and growth, so much that almost everybody and their mother knows what PCR is, right? And knows what antigen testing is, can do their own antigen testing at home. So I think this past few years has represented an incredible growth in public knowledge about respiratory viruses and the testing that we can do. So if I could just summarize this, right, into sort of two big categories for our at-home audience, there are things called antigen tests where we're detecting a little piece of the virus's let's say, shell or clothing, right? Like they're outside presenting pieces. Or there are nucleic acid amplification tests, a type of which is PCR. And these types of tests are, we're looking for the sort of interior genomic material of the virus. These two types of tests have different pros and cons, right? But one of the major things I think for our at-home audience to think about is, in general, our nucleic acid tests or our PCRs are going to be more sensitive, so better at detecting the virus when it's there in low quantities. And however, the problem with the nucleic acid tests is they tend to be less accessible, right? You can't, there's only a few options where you can do that at home or at the point of care, and these traditionally have been concentrated in the laboratory.
Well, Chris, I wonder if you can expound. So what is the importance, or in terms of respiratory viruses, you know, from the clinical side, because the clinicians were always kind of pushing you. And so what rationale do we use for turnaround time and in terms of understanding what may be causing this maybe syndrome of either cough or influenza-like illness?
No, and I think that's the hard part about being a clinician, is like getting this presentation of symptoms and then attempting to order the right test. You know, that is the really hard part. And we try to make the lab as easily accessible to help you make the right decision. And so that's kind of like our dividing point. When it comes to like someone has come to the clinic, to the emergency department, something like that, for, you know, let's say your standard outpatient, they're a little sick. You know, I think the best testing for an outpatient in that setting is like a limited panel or a really targeted test. So you're going to want to get a nucleic acid-based test, so something like PCR, and something for like your heavy hitters, so influenza, COVID, RSV right now. Those kinds of tests are really at the top of the differential. If you're not thinking like bacterial pneumonia, something to that effect, but you're thinking upper respiratory, those types of testing will get you what you need. So you just want to rule in the big things, roll out the big things, and send these patients on their way. Now, that being said, you know, you're seeing someone inpatient, it's a different scenario. You have somebody who is like very challenging to manage, someone who is like really, really sick, they're inpatient. And in that case, you know, you, even as an outpatient, there's a lot of testing at your fingertips. And that's, now that you have, we're talking about an inpatient, a more exhaustive panel of testing might be warranted for these types of patients, because this time you really need to know. It's not like, oh, they're going to get better, they're going to leave. We need to be very sure about what this is. So then you might want to explore the like multi-targeted panel, something that has like 15 targets, bacterial, fungal, and viral diseases on there as well, to give you that peace of mind going forward with their treatment.
Well, thank you for that. I think, you know, from the clinical point of view, it's very humbling. There was an article written probably 20 years ago about how good are clinicians in diagnosing influenza. And as you know, it's about a 50-50 shot. Now, if there's widespread influenza out there, you know, you're going to be more likely to be able to diagnose that. And I think, as you stated, is that there's other respiratory viruses now that can mimic flu-like symptoms. And I think, you know, from our point of view, what my mentor always taught me, Dr. Crawford, is if you're going to order a test, you should understand why you're ordering that test. I think sometimes it's nice to have the diagnosis so the patient knows. Maybe that's a stewardship thing. Other is we have treatment, at least for three of the big viruses you mentioned. Potential treatment could either militate symptoms, especially in those at high risk for progression, whether it's SARS-CoV-2 or influenza. RSV, we don't. But Hannah, if this is a situation, how do you set the menu up to make your clinicians succeed? Because as Chris said, behind the scenes, there is a plethora of things that we may be able to order a la carte or not. So how did you make the decision with the clinicians in terms of what is the best panel to set up during what seasons? I'm just curious, in 2024.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And I think, you know, you have to balance so many different factors, right? So there are the things that Dr. Attaway mentioned in terms of the patient's severity, right, the urgency of care. But I think there are a few key factors with the COVID pandemic that we are new to us. The first is which actually, I think there's a lot of growing interest and demand from the patients to know what respiratory virus is causing their illness, right? And I think we see with all of the research and development that's happened during COVID, how powerful that is. Knowing what virus causes your symptoms means that treatments and vaccines can be developed for it. So if there's not a public awareness that a certain virus is causing disease, then we can't do anything about it, right? So I think that's the piece that I've really learned from the COVID pandemic. sort of other factors, right? This is completely a decision that has to be focused on who your providers are at the hospital, who your patients are at the hospital. And, you know, in terms of the approach we took to set the testing menu here, we really, you know, involved our ID colleagues, our infection prevention colleagues, our ED colleagues, our primary care colleagues, and pediatrics colleagues, and all of those people come together to make a decision about, okay, which patient population is going to get what type of testing. And the last piece of this I want to say is also, it's changing, right? The epidemiology is changing. So I think this year and last year, for the first time, we're seeing this return to maybe some sort of seasonal trend or predictability that was absent during the COVID pandemic. And so, you know, the decision we made was that actually this year we are going to offer flu, RSV, and COVID testing to sort of all patients as the default. Now, clinicians can choose, you know, maybe they only want to do flu and COVID testing, or they only want to do COVID testing. But we made that COVID plus flu plus RSV available to outpatients this year for the first time. And I think that's in recognition of the fact that we have these new vaccines available, right? And we want to promote sort of a better understanding of RSV among our population so that maybe people will seek out that vaccine next year. So I think there's so many factors that go into this decision. As you said, you got to make it with all of your stakeholders in the room. I don't think that the lab alone can make a good decision by themselves, but I also think that decision has to involve the lab. And I'll tell you why with the RSV piece, right, is that actually adding the RSV component didn't, the reagents are a little bit more expensive, but the labor actually, we were able to bring on a new assay that made the labor the same. And so we were able to offer that value to patients without sort of that incredible amount of added cost. And that sort of strategic thinking and planning with all the people in the room at the table, including lab, that's what makes it possible.
Well, thank you. Yeah. You know, Chris, we now focused RSV, the kind of new kid on the block, although I wonder if you can expound a little bit from the lab point of view. RSV is not a new virus, but you know, we were always grew up that, oh my God, this is maybe just a, you know, this is for little kids. Can you explain to our audience about the recognition of the kind of medically attended disease that it causes, not just in infants or the newborns or the small children, but adults?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, same for when I was in medical school, RSV is, that's for children. And that is, you know, that's kind of it. It lurks around otherwise, like anybody of all ages can get them, but it's not a severe disease. It's sort of, you know, cold. And that's kind of where we left it. But in the, I don't know when we call post-pandemic, but we're going to say now in our post-pandemic world, RSV seems to have, you know, combined powers with COVID and influenza, and we've seen these numbers rise, and it's begun to mimic more and more cases, especially older patients, so our greater than 65 patients. We're seeing flu-like illness in these, and RSV being the culprit, which has always been a possibility, but we don't see it as we have in the past. Yeah, and go on.
I was just going to say, and I think, you know, part of that is maybe our increased, you know, awareness around respiratory viruses and the fact that we have these, you know, multiplex panels that enable us to test for multiple viruses with a little less labor involved. And we're defining, you know, we're finding RSV in these patients who are really sick that we didn't previously have an explanation for.
Yeah, the epidemiology, just to continue that, like the epidemiology is interesting now that these nucleic acid testings are so commonplace. This is the baseline test you'll get at most laboratories. And because it has become so simple, historically speaking, trying to get a viral diagnosis into the last 20 years, it has been a long, arduous process for select agents. So actually getting a routine RSV diagnosis, it's the same as like once we start testing, now we're actually seeing the full picture, which is really interesting. And now they've got the vaccine on the market. And again, it's important. Now we should add this testing on to see how that changes the epidemiology.
I'm curious, Dr. Gordon, from your perspective, I saw a paper that was published earlier, I think it was last year, which showed that even though RSV is less common, the presentation actually was more severe in adults who are hospitalized compared to flu and even COVID. I'm curious if that's been your experience clinically as well.
So it's a great question. So I think that was, you know, a nice CDC study which looked at hospitalizations in adults. And to your point, although less prevalent than influenza, those that were hospitalized. Now, there's probably some bias there, right? And when we look at RSV in adults, immunosuppression, which we have a bunch of at the clinic, and again, especially those older than 75. So I think, you know, this goes full circle because the more we are testing for syndrome in viruses, we will, I think, uncover probably more cases that maybe previously weren't tested because of the collective decision now to make that standard for adults during this season. And then the hope is, of course, we'd rather prevent a disease than diagnose it. I think we would all agree with that. And there's our vaccine preventables, which we would now put potentially RSV in that genre now for the first time, at least for adults. So I do think we're in an interesting space as we move forward, but I agree that the lab is so important now because we can be assured about a lot of things, but not necessarily correct. And if we're not testing for it, we actually don't know. Obviously, we care about the patient. So I think this has been a great kind of interaction with the clinicians and the lab and what you all have done. You know, I want to re-pivot because I get a lot of questions from patients. It's like, you know, hey, Dr. Gordon, if I have a flu-like illness, wouldn't it be a lot simpler for both of us if I had a COVID test that I'm doing at home, antigen test that also had flu and RSV so that I can then call you after my testing and show you the results? How far are we away from that? And what are the barriers for that, Hannah?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. You know, I don't think there has been as much movement in the home testing arena for flu and RSV as there has been for COVID. At least I haven't really heard about it. And I think part of this COVID at-home testing is largely driven by sort of isolation guidance, right? And how that diagnosis affects sort of our social and our personal lives. So I don't know, because there hasn't been that same level of guidance for flu and RSV, I don't know that there's the demand as much for, you know, at-home testing at the volume at which manufacturers would need to make that attractive. I think the other problem is that we have seen with influenza antigen testing specifically, that's a antigen test that's very challenging to develop with the rate at which it mutates and also sort of the lower sensitivity. So I think there are challenges there, but we may see something like that one day. I will point out, though, that, you know, there is now a nucleic acid test that's available at home for COVID testing. It uses a type of amplification that, you know, is very fast and can be done at home that doesn't require the type of machinery we need in the laboratory. So I wonder if we might also see development of this sort of at-home testing as well. And the last piece, you know, I'm curious your thoughts about this, Dr. Gordon, but I think patients really, we're seeing with the COVID pandemic that we really need to meet patients where they are in terms of access to testing. And that could be in the form of home testing, but I think also home collection and sending that specimen to a lab to be tested, right? You can Amazon anything. Yes. I don't know if I'm allowed to say Amazon,
yes,
but
yes.
you can ship anything anywhere these days. And I think, you know, one thing we'll have to keep an eye out for is the availability of at-home collection that could be convenient for the patient that gets then sent out to a laboratory where the highest quality of testing can be done. So that may be a form of testing that meets all those criteria.
Well, thank you for that. You know, Chris, what's implied in here is what you all would call the pre-analytics. So I wonder if you can also explain to the audience that box that you all don't control, but can be so important for testing that the Dr. Wong just kind of indirectly spoke about.
Right, yeah. And this is one of the reasons why, so for the at-home, these antigen tests, we really like those because they're at home. The patient can collect the sample themselves. They drop a little drop on it. They wait for a line. Now, the astronomical convenience of it, you sacrifice some sensitivity. So they may not always be positive when you're actually positive. But on the flip side, like Dr. Wong also mentioned, is that this self-collection, pop it in the mailbox, send it away, you can get a nucleic acid-based test, which has significantly higher sensitivity. But now you're adding in the complexities of this pre-analytic phase. Did the patient collect the sample correctly? Did they collect from the right site? Did they pop it into the media? Well, let's say, you know, you've got a swab, it comes with a media, you do that at home. Did they do all this correctly? You know, there's all sorts of variables that can occur between the swab, swabbing the location and then making its way to the vial. And then now it depends on where you live on this planet, because you're going to put that in an envelope, put it in your mailbox. Is it 100 degrees outside? Is it negative 20 degrees outside? Then it goes through this cold chain of just circulating through the mail. And even with the fastest delivery, you know, it could still be, you know, 8 or 9 hours out and about under certain circumstances that nucleic acids don't like to be in. So there's a lot more complexity added, even though we're ideally looking for a better test. So navigating this aspect of the shipping, what's the best container, what's the best way to ship it, what's the fastest way to ship it, so that the lab can actually receive it and perform that test quickly. Now that's the hard part.
I appreciate that. I think, you know, the other side we think about, and I think that there was a powerful message, was test to treat. So if you're testing where the test is going to, potentially the patient is a candidate for treatment, then there's the time aspect, and then you can get a test result, but if a tree falls and no one's around, does anyone hear it? And so there's that other piece of the effector arm, which raises another degree of complexity. But I think, I do think we're moving in this way. Obviously, when we talk about pregnancy testing, there's other home tests that are, this space is exploding. As you said, it's probably not for everyone, but I do think, especially for those caregivers at home that have their kids in daycare where there's a fever, you know, is it strep, is it flu, is it COVID? I think, yeah, you can see where this will be extremely important, not just for test to treat, but also for infection prevention purposes.
Yeah, and I think that's what the lab wants to give people. That's what clinicians want to give people. They give them more power, you know, that they, you know, a lot of people can regulate themselves. Like you said, like they know they were exposed. Somebody has a diagnosis. They're like, oh, I spent all day with that person. I was in an office with that person all day. I have the same symptoms. And they want that peace of mind. That's like, I want to know if I have blank. And to provide them with this opportunity to just order a test. It comes in the mail, send it off. They're like, ah, I knew it. You know, so it kind of gives patients a lot of access, which is what I think we all want. But navigating it in a way that provides them a meaningful result is the hard part.
Yeah.
You know, this raises, I wonder if we can, you know, pivot to other things that the lab helped us with or helped us stay in our lanes about what a positive test means. Dr. Wong talked about cycle thresholds, and we were pushing, what is that cycle threshold? But of course, we were a little, you know, there was probably not a lot of data to support that this meant you had a lot of infection versus a little bit of infection. And then I wonder if you could also talk about the concept of, you know, you can be infected, but not also have disease, and that isn't necessarily a failure of say a vaccine. It might actually mitigate the infection, which a lot of people I think misinterpreted. Oh, I got vaccinated, had a positive COVID test, the vaccine doesn't work.
Right. So this is a great question. And you mentioned that study, right, that, you know, an ID doc can't necessarily tell based on the symptoms what respiratory virus it is. Well, also, the flip side is true. Just because you have a positive test, that doesn't tell you that, you know, you will have a respiratory illness, right? And I think we have to understand that the testing and the clinical signs and symptoms go hand in hand. There is no sort of nucleic acid test for COVID, flu, or RSV that, you know, is only positive in patients who are clinically presenting with illness. And I'd argue that it's also important to be able to detect positives in asymptomatic individuals, because those people may go on to transmit infection to other people, right? So it can be really challenging to interpret nucleic acid tests. And that's where I think the interaction between the clinical team and the lab is so important. I'm sure Dr. Attaway can speak to sort of his experience as a trainee during this time and answering those questions. But that interaction is so important because there, you know, we're tasked with taking what is it's not a quantitative test, but there is information behind that yes, no answer that could be helpful in the right context to the right person to be able to help interpret that assay a little better. And we can't put out that result as if it were a quantitative value because it's not a quantitative test. But it's that dialogue that really ultimately helps provide the additional information for interpretation. I don't know if you want to add anything.
No, the only thing I thought that would be interesting is the interpretation is challenging, and even outside of like CT values and things like that. But I was thinking of the negative aspects of like large multiplex panels, which, you know, I think Dr. Gordon mentioned earlier, you know, like it might provide a like peace of mind to the patient to get a result that's not actionable. And that can be the hard part of like, you know, you have this expensive big panel, gives you a result. Now, is that result does it provide meaning? Not necessarily. And simultaneously, you know, what if you have somebody who is very, very ill, inpatient, you get a big panel, and the only thing that comes back positive is something like rhinovirus. And you're like, Now it's almost convoluted the picture of like, this probably isn't what's causing the disease, but something is, and this might give you sort of false security that maybe it's just something else. So the testing can be very challenging to interpret sometimes, not even just from the, where does it fall on the CT number, but what tests come back positive based on what they find, whether who's carrying, who's actually symptomatic, this kind of stuff. It can be very challenging.
No, thank you for that perspective, because I know I could probably, you know, you can give the top 10, I wouldn't say, but the most interesting queries that you've received over the COVID from clinicians. And I'm sure there are things that will make us, and I'm sure I was probably part of those questions. But I think it's good for the clinicians to actually, it's better to ask a question. There's no such thing as a stupid question, because a lot of clinicians are not trained in the black box behind the lab. And I think that support that we have is just amazing. You know, and I wonder, because the other thing is test of cure, which also came up. And, you know, it's interesting to note, I think we're going to see some guidance now on return to either the workplace or workspace following a COVID infection is going to now fall back into traditional other respiratory viruses, where one would say, you know, once your symptoms abate, the fever's gone, you can go back to wherever you want to go. But I wonder if you can tell us, where is the role for test of cure, if there is any, for any of the respiratory viral pathogens?
That's like an amazing question, especially in light of, right, the very recent change in terms of isolation guidance from the CDC. So, you know, I think this is a great question. The question is, why are we testing for cure, right? Are we trying to say that, you know, this patient's symptoms have resolved and they no longer need a drug or a therapy, right? Very sick patient who's maybe immunocompromised and admitted, do they need convalescent plasma or not? You know, these sorts of decisions. Or is it to say, is this person capable of onward transmission, right? And I think, I can't really speak to this, but I think in the U.S. as a society, we've sort of decided that if you look at our public health guidance and whatnot, we've sort of decided that we're not going to be able to prevent onward transmission using test of cure, because that comes with a bunch of difficulties and challenges logistically that sort of as a society, we need to all agree that we're willing to accept. And I don't think we're there, right? And so then if you're not willing to do the arm that says we're going to isolate and we're going to do something different for patients who are positive after, let's say, 5 days of, you know, initial test, then what's the point of testing? And so I think those two arms have to go hand in hand. You can't test for a cure and then not do anything about it. You have to decide what you're going to do with that result. There is no test of cure necessarily, but what we basically do know is that as time goes on, patients can continue to be positive for respiratory viruses, even if they're asymptomatic. So what we do with that, I think, is a public health decision.
No, thank you for that. And I think most of us have, you know, we have not adopted the test of cure for SARS-CoV-2 or other things, realizing that the test could remain positive. It's rendered until asymptomatic. Perhaps the only exception would be our very immunosuppressed patients, which we know have difficulty clearing all sorts of viruses. And in our guidance to them has always been, you're going to have to try to protect yourselves, that is masking in public or avoiding those situations, because the rest of the public is probably not, it isn't going to do that at this point in time, or is an expectation. Chris, anything you want to add to it?
Yeah, the only thing I was going to add is something that Dr. already touched on, is that the test for cure, there isn't one, but you know, patients, I'm sure you've had patients come to you and they, quote, need a negative test, you know, and especially historically speaking, they needed a negative test to visit relatives, to travel, to do what have you. But, you know, this is the hard part of working with humans, is that everybody is really different. And Dr. Wong mentioned, you know, there are patients who will be positive for a long time after they got sick, or they may be asymptomatic to begin with and be positive for so long after. So like, even with the current methods we have, like getting that negative test, if you wanted to even call that a test of cure, it's just different for every person. And so I know there has to be listeners who have been like, oh yeah, I had COVID, and then 2 months later, I still had a positive test, and there's just no right way to go about it.
No, thank you.
I wonder if we could pivot now to, I mean, we've talked about the individuals and all the great work and expertise that has been done and that you have provided us. But I'm wondering, we talk about public health, and the other thing that was, I think, fascinating that came out of COVID was the wastewater surveillance of sewage in, you know, whatever you could, if kind of just give us the ABCs there, because I find that to be obviously a different sampling, a different way, but very, very interesting and powerful.
Yeah, I agree with you. The data that I have seen has shown that wastewater sampling and surveillance is incredibly powerful and pretty accurate. I'll give you an example. Earlier last year, there was circulation of a new variant of SARS-CoV-2 that we detected in our population through genomic, you know, screening that we do with ODH, or Ohio Department of Health. We detected this one patient who had this new variant of COVID, but at the very same time, basically the same day, that variant was also detected in wastewater. So it just shows the power of wastewater surveillance, and I think the data I've seen have shown that, you know, I think done in the right way, it's challenging. You have to do it right, but it can be very, very powerful and is increasingly important as patients move to non-laboratory-based testing, because a lot of our public health reporting relies on data fed from the laboratory. So I think this new stream of data is going to be increasingly useful and important as testing becomes decentralized.
I like that. And Chris had brought up health equity and everything else. As Hannah, you mentioned, most of our surveillance today depends on someone access to care getting the test. In wastewater sewage surveillance, which I know sounds gross, but it, everything. But you obviously, if you're hooked up to the sewer, which most Americans are, you then can contribute, obviously, to the detection. And there's been some wonderful, interesting things, polio and other aspects. Now, I also heard in New York City, of course, there's other things that can contribute to the sewer that are non-human. So whether it's rats or things of this nature. So you're measuring all sorts of potentially, some of these are zoonosis. But I find that to be fascinating and another piece of the tool. Chris, anything that you want to add about that or that your reflections on WWS?
No, I just think it is very interesting. And I don't know how much the listeners know, but, you know, I think people are somewhat familiar with like influenza. Like a lot of diseases are reportable, like, and that means like they are sent to places like the CDC, your state health. And some people are not always aware of like how exhaustive that list may be. And these things are tracked to within an inch of their life, you know, so it is like for the greater good of the public, you know, that if you have a positive test, it is reported to the state and the federal level. And, you know, when things start to not add up, that's what's very helpful for infection control purposes. So when like there's a new variant on the stage, oh, it's being detected in these locations, you can predict trends. And it is very interesting that, you know, it, as you said, it's very gross wastewater, but, you know, there's a silver lining to it being processed through a facility that is able to measure these types of things. And they measure lots of things. So it is very interesting, all the things that they do for us.
Well, in closing, this has been fascinating. Again, gratitude to you both and to the lab. I think it was probably only the second or third time where you saw the CEO of the clinic actually go to the lab. And that just reflects that you guys are like the BASF. It's the things behind making things work well. And I think the lab got a lot of appropriate gratitude in terms of, as you mentioned, that not just developing the test volume in the pandemic, but also keeping the other service lines going. And it's just truly amazing. And we were very, very fortunate to have talent and all your hard work and your teams. And again, I think this has been, it'll be fascinating to see where the future holds too in terms of testing, in terms of, as you taught us, the right test for the right situation. But I wonder if we can end just if I could put you on the spot a little bit, is there anything you're reading, book, medical or not medical, that you might recommend to the listening audience? So Hannah, we'll start with you.
Oh man, that is an interesting question. So my reading is generally not medical. I actually got a recommendation on a book from a colleague, Dr. Harrington. She directs our acid fast bacilli lab, as well as yourself. It's The Covenant of Water. It's sort of one of the most powerful books I have read in a long time. And I don't want to sort of give away the ending for any listeners on the line, but I think it helps me reflect on the power, I think, of medicine and public health in terms of combating disease. And as a reminder, I think of the, not just the impact we have medically for patients, but socially and on people's personal lives. And I think, you know, renews my passion and drive for what I do.
Well, thank you for that. And yeah. That is written by your former colleague, Abraham Verghese, who's an ID clinician at Stanford. So, yeah. So thank you for that. And Chris, I do shout out for Chris. You know, he runs a lot of our monthly or weekly Clin Micro, and it is, for me, it's like an off-Broadway. It's not only entertaining, but also very educational. So I'm very curious to see what your book recommendation will be.
I try to bridge the gap. So you have the insider knowledge that I'm a history person, and so I only read things that are true as a rule.
I'm the opposite.
I know. But I did just finish reading a very incredible book, which is called The Warmth of Other Suns. And it is an incredible book. It's, of course, all true. It follows three people who grew up in the South and then they moved to the West and the North. And this follows the Great Migration. So when Black or African-American people left between basically 1910 and the 1970s, when they left their homes for better opportunities elsewhere. But it is really incredible to follow their journey from, because I've been to all the places they've been to. As I said, I'm a rural Southern boy. I've been to all the places that they were from. So it's very interesting to see the places that they went and how they got there and what their lives were like, if they were different at all. It is very powerful. And I think the things that these people saw are still evident in our landscape today. So I think that's kind of like the most interesting part about it.
Well, again, my name is Steve Gordon, and just gratitude to our guests, Dr. Wong, Dr. Attaway, for a nice, great overview of microbiology testing with a focus on RSV and respiratory viruses. Thank you both, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Respiratory Exchange podcast. For more stories and information from the Cleveland Clinic Respiratory Institute, you can follow me on Twitter at @TryAdWakeMD.